Today is May the 5th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, that's the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Michael Collins, an astronaut who flew on the most historic space mission, has passed away. Michael Collins, age 90, was part of the three-member crew on Apollo 11, the first lunar landing mission in 1969. Unlike Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, he never walked on the moon. Collins stayed behind and piloted the command module as it circled above. Because of that, Collins is often called the forgotten astronaut. Collins had been battling cancer. A statement released by his family said, "He spent his final days peacefully with his family by his side. Michael always faced the challenges of life with grace and humility, and faced this, his final challenge, in the same way." When Armstrong and Aldrin landed on the moon, and Armstrong uttered the famous phrase, "Houston, Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed," Collins was in orbit, 60 miles above, just as busy and just as excited, telling the team back in Houston he was listening to communications with his comrades, and it was fantastic. He was a keystone of the mission. As he orbited, he could talk to the controllers half the time, but when he was on the backside of the moon, he was completely cut off. It was because of this part of the mission that some dubbed him the loneliest man in humanity. It's a shame that when people are asked, "Can you name the Apollo 11 crew?" Michael Collins is normally the name that doesn't come to mind. Because in many ways, he was the keystone of the mission. He was the only one who really knew how to fly the spacecraft and the only one who could get all three of them home. NASA chose him as an astronaut in 1963, and his first flight was aboard Gemini 10. On that mission, he became the fourth human to conduct a spacewalk. Apollo 11 was his final trip to space, and he never dwelled on missing a chance to step on the moon. "As an astronaut, I always thought I had the best job in the world, and I think that when it was over, it was over." Broadband providers revolt against New York State law that forces them to offer $15 and $20 plans. New York State enacted its cheap broadband law 2 weeks ago and called it the first in the nation requirement for affordable internet for qualifying low-income families. The state law requires $15 broadband plans with download speeds of at least 25 megabits per second, with the $15 being inclusive of any recurring taxes and fees, such as recurring rental fees for service provider equipment required to obtain broadband service and usage fees. In other words, New York State is asking the ISPs to also pay for the taxes for the service. ISPs can alternatively comply by offering $20 per month service with 200 megabits per second speeds, and price increases would be capped at 2% per year. The state is required to review download speed requirements within 2 years and at least once every 5 years thereafter to determine whether they should be raised. Minimum upload speeds are not specified by the law. States can regulate broadband through consumer protection powers, and New York will argue that its cheap broadband requirement is not preempted by federal law. A coalition of broadband associations representing providers such as AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile sued New York on Friday over law passed earlier that requires them to offer affordable internet for low-income families at rates of $15 and $20 per month beginning in mid-June. The lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of New York. the broadband lobby groups asked for preliminary and permanent injunctions preventing enforcement of the law. In the lawsuit, the coalition argues that New York has no authority to regulate broadband prices because broadband services fall under the purview of the federal government. The suit asks the court to invalidate the New York law, ruling that its enforcement would be illegal and prevent the state from regulating broadband rates. The coalition includes the New York State Telecommunications Association, CTIA, ACA Connects, U.S. Telcom, NTCA, and SBCA. Specifically, the coalition claims that the New York State law is in conflict with a 2018 decision by the Federal Communications Commission that affirms that regulating broadband like a common carrier, whose rates can be regulated, is contrary to public's interest. The same FCC decision changed broadband classification from a common carrier service to an information service. The New York law also violates the Communications Act, prohibiting against forcing information services to comply with common carrier regulation, the group states. In addition, although the coalition acknowledges that there is a need to close the digital divide and ensure broadband is available to all Americans, including low-income households, it states that broadband providers already offer low-cost plans for these groups. They also participate in federal programs that provide subsidies to help low-income households access broadband, such as Lifeline and the FCC's Emergency Broadband Benefit Program, the latter of which will go into effect on May the 12th. New York affirms that the new law will affect 7 million New Yorkers and 2.7 million households. Members of the public that qualify for the new $15 and $20 monthly rates for high-speed broadband and higher-speed broadband, respectively, include households which are eligible or receiving free or reduced price lunch, receive supplemental nutrition assistance programs benefits, Medicaid benefits, and the senior citizens, or disability rent increase exemptions, among others, according to Governor Cuomo's office. In a statement, CTIA, a nonprofit that represents the wireless communications industry, which is part of the coalition that filed the lawsuit, said that New York law is overruled by federal law in the matter. While well-intended, this bill is preempted by federal law and ignores the $50 monthly broadband discount recently enacted by Congress, as well as the many unprecedented commitments, donations, and accommodations that broadband providers have made for low-income consumers since the pandemic began. The CTIA said, "We urge state policymakers to coordinate with their federal counterparts and with the broadband industry to better serve the needs of New Yorkers." In a statement on Friday, Governor Cuomo said he anticipated this response from the companies. He accused the providers of putting profits ahead of creating a more fair and just society, and he affirmed and welcomed the fight, and he said, "Bring it on." The FCC releases sign-up date and website for $50 per month broadband subsidies. May 12th, enrollment for people who have low incomes or lost income during the pandemic. Enrollment for the $50 per month broadband subsidies for U.S. residents with low incomes or those who lost income during the pandemic will begin on May the 12th. The Federal Communications Commission announced that they also set up a new website at which people can sign up for the subsidies. As of May 12th, eligible households will be able to enroll in the program to receive a monthly discount off the cost of broadband service from an approved provider. Eligible households can enroll through an approved provider or by visiting getemergencybroadband.org, one word, getemergencybroadband.org. Congress approved the subsidies in December, but it took a few months for the FCC to set up the program. The FCC had previously said enrollment would begin at the end of April. Check the list of providers to determine whether your ISP is participating in the discount program. There's also a Companies Near Me tool that will become active closer to the May 12th start date. The Emergency Broadband Benefit Program will provide eligible households with discounts of up to $50 a month for broadband service and up to $75 a month if the household is on tribal lands. It also will provide a one-time discount of up to $100 on a computer or tablet for eligible households. The subsidies will not last indefinitely. They will end when the fund runs out of money or 6 months after the Department of Health and Human Services declares an end to the COVID-19 health emergency, whichever is sooner. The program website said participating households will need to opt in to continue receiving broadband services from their provider after the program ends. If a household chooses to continue receiving service after the end of the emergency broadband benefit program, they will be billed the broadband provider's general monthly rate. Congress provided $3.2 billion for the subsidies, and pending legislation would add another $6 billion to the emergency fund if it's approved. There are multiple ways to qualify. Households with incomes at or below 135% of federal poverty's guidelines qualify for the subsidy, as explained on the Do I Qualify page. The subsidy is also available to households if any member of the household qualifies for lifeline benefits through participation in SNAP, Medicaid, Supplemental Security Income, Federal Public Housing Assistance, or Veterans and Survivors Pension Benefit, or participates in one of several tribal-specific programs, Bureau of Indian Affairs General Assistance, the Tribal Head Start, Tribal Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, and Food Distribution Program on Indian Reservations. Another category is experience a substantial loss of income since February 29, 2020, with a total household income in 2020 at or below $99,000 for single filers and $198,000 for joint filers, or receive a federal Pell Grant in the current award year, or receive approval for benefits under the Free and Reduced Price School Lunch Program or the School Breakfast Program, including through the USDA Community Eligibility Provision in the 2019 to 2020 or 2020 to the 2021 school year, or meets the eligibility criteria for participating providers' existing low-income or COVID-19 program, and that provider receives FCC approval for its eligibility verification process. The FCC website explains how to apply and lists the documents people may need to provide to prove that they are eligible. Verizon sells its media business to Apollo Global Management. In a deal valued at $5 billion, as a mobile phone giant focuses on building out its 5G network, Yahoo and AOL, early internet pioneers, are sold to private equity firm Apollo. Yahoo and AOL, kings of the early internet, saw their fortune decline as Silicon Valley raced ahead to create new digital platforms. Google replaced Yahoo, and AOL was supplanted by cable giants. Now they will become the property of private equity. Verizon, their current owner, agreed to sell them to Apollo Global Management in a deal worth $5 billion. The business housing the two brands, Verizon Media, is to be renamed Yahoo without the exclamation point, and the sale will also include its advertising technology business. Verizon will retain a 10% stake in the newly formed media group. The head of Verizon's media business will continue to lead the new Yahoo. He added that Yahoo will now have the investment and resources needed to elevate the business to the next level, suggesting that the company will be able to develop new sources of income, such as subscriptions and e-commerce. The company does not plan any layoffs for now. Yahoo used to be the front page of the internet, cataloging the furious pace of the new websites that sprang up in the late 1990s. AOL was once the service that millions of people used to get online. But both were ultimately supplanted by nimbler startups. Google and Facebook became the dominant forces of the web, and Yahoo and AOL became giant publishers instead. Yahoo Sports is a popular destination with sports fans, and Yahoo Finance is a wealth of information for retail traders. AOL acquired a raft of early media brands, including the Huffington Post, TechCrunch, and Engadget, and several digital ad tech companies to create a giant platform for advertising. Verizon's current chief executive, Hans Vestberg, was appointed in 2018. At the time, he lauded the work of the media division, but fast internet on phones was key to the company's health, and he redoubled efforts to build out Verizon's new 5G network. In 2018, Verizon announced the restructuring of the media unit. In early 2019, it laid off about 800 workers, which is about 7% of the staff. Last year, Verizon began to dismantle the media group with the sale of The Huffington Post to BuzzFeed. Verizon has had to spend big to improve its mobile business. In March, it agreed to pay nearly $53 billion to license wireless airwaves to help with the company expand its 5G infrastructure. It also plans to spend $10 billion over the next few years to wire more cell towers and upgrade its systems. The company's total debt now exceeds $180 billion, and its net debt is more than 3 times its annual pre-tax profits. Typically, the industry prefers to keep that ratio closer to 2.5. For Apollo, the purchase is an opportunity to further invest in the digital media space, an industry it has already put money into, with deals for the photo printing business Shutterfly, the web hosting company Rackspace, and Cox Media Group, which owns TV and radio stations throughout the country. Apollo also has plenty of experience with the complex process of buying businesses spun out from larger companies, which generally requires separation of interwoven financials, systems, and often key executives. Yahoo and AOL still generates plenty of revenue. Verizon's media division recorded $1.9 billion in sales in the first 3 months of this year, a 10% gain over the prior year. Apollo is hoping that an increased focus on the individual brands it believes are lost inside a large corporate empire can accelerate that growth. One strategy could be to add more subscription offerings. Yahoo Finance already sells a premium service on top of the free website. Apollo also sees an opportunity for Yahoo Sports to take a bigger piece of the online betting and fantasy sports industries, which have seen explosive growth. Apollo is notably upbeat about digital advertising amid regulatory scrutiny of some of the biggest players like Google. And as digital ads rebound post-pandemic, Apollo expects the overall industry to grow. T-Mobile to retire Wi-Fi calling on select devices come May the 31st. Introduced back in 2015, Wi-Fi calling was supposed to revolutionize the most important aspect of phones, voice calls. Unfortunately, the technology behind Wi-Fi calling 1.0 is too old to continue to be supported, especially with the launch of Wi-Fi calling 2.0 not long ago. That's the main reason T-Mobile announced that it has decided to discontinue Wi-Fi calling 1.0 after May the 31st, which means devices that support this particular feature will no longer work. Of course, this change won't impact devices that support Wi-Fi calling 2.0 or later, nor data access over Wi-Fi. You can check on the T-Mobile website to find out what data phones are impacted by this change. The phones that they list are pretty old devices, so I doubt that there are too many T-Mobile customers still using them. However, if your T-Mobile smartphone doesn't support Wi-Fi calling 2.0, know that you won't be able to use Wi-Fi calling after May the 31st. The rest of the features will remain accessible no matter what smartphone you're using, including internet access and voice calls via cellular network. Microsoft is cutting the Adobe Flash cord in July. Adobe Flash officially reached end of life at the end of 2020, and now Microsoft is removing Flash from Windows 10 this summer. While Microsoft has already started to remove support for Flash from a number of its apps, including its Edge browser. There is still some native support for Adobe Flash Player built into the Windows 10 itself, which Microsoft is now planning to remove via Windows Update. In a recent update on the matter, Microsoft said it will begin sending out the patch to remove Adobe Flash from Windows 10 starting in June, first to users who are part of Microsoft's preview program before the patch becomes a mandatory update in July. Microsoft says that going forward, all systems running Windows 10 version 21H1, which is sometime this summer, or later will have Flash removed by default. In addition to removing the native Flash support from Windows 10, Microsoft is also planning on removing Flash from older versions of Windows as well, including Windows 8.1, Windows Server 2012, and Windows Embedded 8 Standard. And in case you don't want to wait for June, you can also remove Flash from Windows 10 manually by downloading and installing KB4577586. That's KB4577586, update from the Microsoft Update Catalog. Adobe Flash has been on its way out for the past several years, so it makes sense for Microsoft to do a final pass and remove native support for Flash from Windows 10, thereby eliminating all the security issues often associated with Adobe's outdated multimedia format. However, for those feeling nostalgic about Flash games from days gone by, you can still play a number of titles using the Internet Archive. And if you don't find a specific game you're looking for, you can also try apps like Blue Maxima Flashpoint, which is essentially a multi-platform Flash emulator for Windows, macOS, and Linux PCs. Depending on which installer you choose and what OS you're on, Flashpoint even comes with a library of more than 38,000 old Flash games. The total file size for Flashpoint Ultimate 9.0 is a whopping 532 gigabytes, providing you with a wealth of content from a previous generation of the Internet. Flash is dead. Long live Flash. Verizon loses 82,000 pay TV subscribers and 178,000 wireless phone subscribers in the first quarter. Verizon Communications said it lost more wireless subscribers than expected during the first quarter as it battled intense competition from T-Mobile and AT&T to attract customers. Verizon lost 178,000 wireless phone subscribers in the first quarter, more than 121,700 subscribers lost estimated by FactSet. Verizon lost 82,000 net pay subscribers for its Fios consumer video service in the first quarter, compared with a loss of 84,000 in the year-ago period and a loss of 72,000 in the fourth quarter. But there is a silver lining. They had more than 5% higher than last year Fios internet service. The telecom giant is also shifting its video focus away from Fios TV to partnership with third-party streaming services as it positions itself as a key distribution platform for them. Verizon has a deal with the Walt Disney Company for the Disney Bundle, which gives customers with select Verizon Wireless unlimited plans access to Disney streaming services, Disney Plus, Hulu, and ESPN Plus. Microsoft is boosting its support for the Python programming ecosystem. Microsoft sponsorship funds will be used to improve the packaging ecosystem. Microsoft is now a visionary sponsor of the Python Software Foundation. Microsoft has said it is increasing its support for the Python community while pledging to open source as much of the work that they do as possible to push the programming language forward in emerging fields like data science. Microsoft pledged $150,000 in financial sponsorship to the Python Software Foundation the nonprofit organization that holds the rights to the increasingly popular language created by Guido van Rossum back in 1991. Microsoft said part of the funding would go towards improving the Python package index and the wider packaging ecosystem. Microsoft has been a sponsor of the Programming Software Foundation since 2006, but has amped up its involvement in the Python ecosystem in recent years amid the programming language's rapid rise in popularity. In November of last year, Van Rossum, who is also the president of the Python Software Foundation, came out of retirement to head up the company's developers division. As distinguished engineer, Van Rossum is primarily exploring performance improvements to CPython, the original reference implementation of the Python programming language, written in the C programming language. Microsoft open source extension for Visual Studio Code is the company's most popular extension in the company's marketplace for developers. Microsoft has also open sourced the Jupyter extension, the DebugPy debug engine, and the PyWrite type checker, alongside several others. The Python Software Foundation credited Microsoft for helping advance the Python tooling and ecosystem and showing strong involvement with the Python community through its sponsorship of events such as PyCon US, one of the world's largest and most well-known Python developer convention. The foundation said in a statement, "Microsoft helps millions of Python developers achieve more by enabling Python support across products and services like Windows, Visual Studio Code, GitHub, and Microsoft Azure. This year, we are excited that Microsoft is increasing their contributions to the Python Software Foundation even further as a visionary sponsor. Microsoft sponsorship funds will be used to support the Python Software Foundation with a focus on working with the Packaging Working Group on improving the packaging ecosystem." Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Post-COVID Return to Office Part 4.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and I've been an IT professional for, nearly 30 years. I'm here to share my knowledge from both sides of the technical support experience to make your life better, to make it easier. This is part 4 in a 5-part series on the technical support phone call and working it better to your advantage. If you've missed any part of this, go back to the podcast, listen to this. It's an amazing series. I've delivered this in seminars before, and I love this. Last week was about making the phone call. This week is about escalating that call to new levels. This transition from your current helper to the next one requires patience. It requires a polite attitude. All the way along, abusive language should be avoided. Any words that you don't want your 6-year-old saying, well, you have no business saying them at any point in time, even if you get casual and relaxed and you think things are going well. And the reason for this is you might slip up. You might then extend those words throughout normal conversation. If you're of that type, I don't use those words, but I've heard this. So once you venture down the road of cursing, once you venture down the road of screaming or abuse, they can hang up. The technical support folks can mark you down as DNH. Do not help. That's the curse of being canceled. You may be escalated, or you may decide that you need escalation to the next level. Now, escalation to the next level on their side is great, as long as it's, you know, that nice, pleasant escalation where they say, I'm not sure I can help you. Let me get you on to the next technician. All right, but we need to also address getting your escalation. Now, I don't want you to be afraid to ask for the next level if the technician is not helping, but you need to be very nice. You need to be calm. You need to advise your concerns, also mentioning here and there that you know their time, the one that you're dealing with right now, is valuable. Two things can happen here. You can be escalated, which is good, or they'll resist. Now, I've met with resistance many times, but what I do is I slowly, here and there, in between the conversation bits, I build a case for escalation. I establish that I've already tried many things that I've heard them suggest here. I will, after a couple more, I may explain, hey, there's a logic error in this. I'm not sure that this is going to fix this because this is unrelated. What you're having me do is unrelated. Now, I do this in a kind manner. I explain also at this point in time that my problem appears to be beyond the script or beyond what their capabilities are. I do this nicely, and you may have to establish something different. Again, always do it nicely. You don't want to call back. That's the kiss of death. It does not fill your immediate needs. So you'll hear supervisors in some important meeting, and so are their bosses. So are their bosses' bosses. You really don't want to climb that high at once, but you also need to understand that you can ask for escalation to a boss. Nighttime is harder, but it's usually workable. You want to explain that you're seeking resolution now. You're not looking for a callback because you've lost faith in the promise of return calls. Not from your company, of course. I've had problems in the past with other companies. So if you must, I want you to insist on a call within a specific time frame. All right. You want to request also a point of escalation if no return call is made. So you're escalating me to Mary. She's going to call me back in the next 2 hours. If she doesn't, do you have her direct line? Let me note that down. Okay, great. Thank you. Your goal at a certain point, if you're no longer gaining ground, if you're no longer working towards resolution, is to work the cost numbers in your favor. Carefully. Remember that do not help issue. Well, until you're abusive, until you're foul, until you are aggressive, they actually shouldn't hang up. Now, how do you get leverage to get to that next level from somebody who's being stubborn? I know that you've already noted their names already. We've already discussed that previously. I want you to ask them to confirm their name again. Thomas, that was your name, right? Okay, Thomas, can you explain to me why I'm not being escalated? Surely you're not refusing escalation, are you? See what I've done there? So I've used their name, and I've also used that as an opportunity to ask for escalation, and why am I not being escalated? You laid out like that nicely. You make a plea after a while. Give them a chance to, you know, if they're stubborn, you're going to let them calm down a little bit. Make a plea explaining that you understand it's not their fault, but they do have power to help you by escalating the call. Empower them to transfer your call to someone who can help you. Calmly repeat your desire for escalation. You're going to lather, rinse, repeat, okay? After escalation, I want you to confirm the names and the titles. Be very careful. Note down, they sometimes will do a fake escalation to the person at the next desk. It's a peer. That's all right. Work it through again. And you can calmly repeat this process over and over again. I want you to ignore the previous levels. Do not beat up the supervisor for his report's inadequacies. That's going to be the kiss of death as well. Document the names, document the actions, and after a while, you're going to calmly request escalation again. Save your righteous indignation for people way up the level, way up on the high end of this food chain. And only then, when they actually completely, totally fail you, but yet you still want them to remain calm, collected, and impersonal. Do not get personal. Do not call them individually names. Next week, we'll cover what you do after the call. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The cable television business is changing. More than 20% of millennials have never had a cable TV subscription. The digital landscape continues to change when it comes to how we access entertainment. What once seemed normal, like grabbing the remote and flipping through TV channels to find something to watch, is steadily becoming a thing of the past. So much so that newer generations see traditional TV viewing as obsolete. A recent survey by Verizon reveals that 1 in 5 millennials have never subscribed to a cable or satellite television service. This is a generation born in the 1980s and 90s that certainly grew up watching Saturday morning cartoons and waiting until commercial breaks to run to the kitchen for snacks. So while they're no longer strangers to the traditional way of watching TV, millennials are also quick to adapt and accept streaming services such as their sole way to watch TV. By streaming content instead of watching on pay TV, viewers have more freedom to choose when and where they watch, which is also big for the rising generations. Binge watching is the new movie marathon equivalent, with 47% of Gen Zers saying they prefer to binge versus watch episodic content. While streaming is clearly the preferred way to go for younger adults and teens, 62% of U.S. adult households in the survey currently subscribe to a cable or satellite television service. However, nearly 1 in 4 say they cut the cord and have switched to streaming. Nearly half of adults, 47%, to say they have subscribed to a new streaming service since the start of the pandemic, which has clearly boosted consumers' interest in accessing new entertainment. And 70% say they have binge-watched shows at least once or twice. Overall, traffic on major streaming sites is up 21% today compared to pre-pandemic levels, according to Verizon Network data. During a time of isolation, with a global pandemic raging, viewers were able to find common ground with their friends and family with TV shows and movies, even while being miles apart. In fact, 44% of people say that bonding over streaming content has helped them feel more connected to the others during the pandemic. These elevated streaming habits we've developed during quarantine seem to be here to stay. Viewers who currently stream content say they anticipate spending the amount of time or even more than they are now watching streaming service content a year from now. Which operating system is most secure? Windows, Mac OS, or Linux? The short answer is none of the above. It is a myth to say one operating system is more secure than another. Is there any objective metric to answer the question of which is the most secure? Some experts say Windows is the least secure because of its installed base. Windows is the most targeted of all operating systems simply because the size of the installed base makes it the most efficient to attack. If you're writing malware that can run on 88% of the machines being used in the enterprise, you're much more likely to affect more systems. While that is statistically true, that doesn't mean Windows is inherently less secure than other operating systems. Some will say Linux is the most secure because it's open source. Open source projects means that everyone and anyone can inspect the source code, at least in theory. The fact that there are many eyes on the code should mean that bugs and flaws are spotted and fixed quickly. Then there is the perception that Mac OS is the most secure because Apple marketing makes a big deal of security being built in. The inference is the other operating systems do not have built-in security. Well, let's go behind the hype. A newly discovered vulnerability broke through most of Mac OS's newer security protections with a double click of a malicious app, a feat not meant to be allowed under Apple's watch. A family of Mac malware had been exploiting this vulnerability for months. Mac OS flags potentially malicious apps masquerading as documents that have been downloaded from the internet. But security researcher Cedric Owen said the bug he found in mid-March bypasses those checks and allows a malicious app to run. The bug allowed him to build a potentially malicious app to look like a harmless document, which when open, bypasses Mac OS's built-in defenses when open. The discovered vulnerability was subsequently patched by Apple. It fixed a bug in Mac OS 11.3, and Apple also patched the earlier Mac OS versions to prevent abuse and pushed out updated rules to XProtect, which is Mac OS's built-in anti-malware engine, to block malware from exploiting the vulnerability. And with Apple, there was this San Bernardino iPhone case back in 2016. It was an example of Apple's security built into iOS that it could still be broken. It was a battle between Apple and the federal government over encrypted technology. The federal government essentially attempted to bully Apple into decrypting its own product, with the FBI suing the phone maker for access. The tech giant refused, and the lawsuit was subsequently dropped. The feud wasn't really about technical access to the phone. Instead, the feds were merely trying to set a legal precedent that would allow them to call on the private sector to decrypt products for them in the future or install backdoors in encrypted tech. Indeed, a 2018 Justice Department Inspector General's report showed that the FBI didn't really try that hard to find other options before it toted out its lawsuit against Apple. It just wanted to compel the tech company to do its work for it. The FBI fought a long protracted battle with Apple over the unlocking of the phone. It was as much about setting up a precedent and a new expectation in the public relations sense than it was about getting valuable information off the terrorist's phone. It still is unclear what the specifics of the hack entailed or even who precisely cracked the phone for the FBI, but there are unconfirmed reports that the agency will be able to use the same hack again in the future. By the way, Apple would like to know what the hack was, but that information was not released to Apple. How secure is Linux? A crafty piece of malware written for Linux has managed to hide in plain sight since at least 2018. Security researchers have found that after 3 years in the wild, it's just the tip of the iceberg. Its purpose remains a mystery. Researchers at Kihu 360 NetLab are calling it Rota Jacquero. It uses rotating encryption keys and is a two-headed beast of sorts in that it executes different code for root and non-root accounts. It dates back to 2018. At least four Rota Jacquero samples have been uploaded to VirusTotal, a website that scans files with over 60 antivirus engines. The most recent upload occurred in January of this year. The collection of antivirus engines returned a clean bill of health in each instance, leading the Kihu 360 NetLab security team to wonder if there are more samples out there. That is not the only mystery, though. What the researchers do know is that Rota Jacquero supports a dozen functions. Three of them are related to plugins. For what purpose is not yet clear. It is capable of creating a backdoor into infected 64-bit Linux machines, which in theory could allow an attacker to steal sensitive information. Then, with Linux, there is the recent case of the University of Minnesota banned from contributing to the Linux kernel after researchers from the school apparently knowingly submitted code with security flaws. There was no mention the establishment of a peer review process for all changes to open source code. The most vulnerable operating system are the ones where malware has not been caught in a timely fashion. When malware eludes detection by all antivirus applications, you have a real concern for security. It is the malware that escapes detection that lives in its unknown state that makes the operating system insecure. It lulls the public thinking they have a most secure operating system. So which operating system is the most secure? Windows, Mac OS, or Linux? None of the above. Remember to do your regular backups. Presenting Marty Winston with his All Hands on Tech, Cleveland's new MUVE crew headquarter debut.
You are so going to love the tech in this one. It's about a $60,000 robot that you don't have to buy. A quasi-autonomous robot, meaning once you map a path for it, the robot can follow that path, but also make path adjustments and work around obstacles. It's about the most intensely powerful deep ultraviolet germicidal UVC beam on anything like it, meaning it can thoroughly disinfect a space while covering 12 feet in as little as 8 seconds. These aren't droids. No, they are quasi-autonomous robots. And a fleet of these robots debuted on Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you. Along with a crew of trained and certified operators for them. So, now let's give a little shape and context to their story. The company behind these robots is Energy Focus, based in Solon, Ohio, a suburb of Cleveland. And full disclosure here, I began consulting to Energy Focus last November, mostly about things other than this robot. The prototype that was there at the time struck me as ugly. It looked like a water heater on an oversized Roomba. Oh, brother. But when they fired it up, most of its front was a high-intensity UVC lamp, a straight-line lamp in a long parabolic reflector. That was the prototype. The robots that debuted on Tuesday lost to the ugly, much nicer looking, but a tall pillar along the right side still sports that long lamp and reflector setup. Over time, you may come to recognize Energy Focus as a company that adores typographic puns. In the case of this robot, they named it MUVE, M-U-V-E, MUVE with a U to put UV in the middle. They're not selling MUVE robots yet. They plan to submit to UL first, but they are making them available in a way. That gets more interesting once you understand more about their purpose. The MUVE is a pathogen assassin. Yes, coronavirus and all its variants, and other viruses, and bacteria, and mold, and so on. Its realm is surfaces, surface disinfection, where contact contagion tends to happen. It's not intended to do air disinfection, though a lot of that happens when it's running. But running a pathogen purging platform with high-intensity UVC is mostly about surfaces. In terms of germs in a room, it's very much like a reboot. More about that in a moment. When you research UVC and its impact against microorganisms, you learn that eliminating 99.9% or 99.999% or whatever population exorcism you want, well, that means exposing them to something strong enough, exposing them long enough, and being close enough to be effective. So, do you remember studying optics in science class? Those big reflectors are part of the secret sauce of these robots. And here's another little secret. Something that looks like reflective to you in visible light isn't necessarily reflective for deep ultraviolet UVC. That's a 254 nanometer wavelength. Energy Focus tested scores of reflective materials by using calibrated UVC sources and dosimeters. They found a winner. Sorry, but they won't allow me to tell you what that was. You may have seen photos of UVC disinfecting gizmos that just stand one or more tubes upright and let them shine across a full 360-degree circle. Not these robots. Concentrating the deep ultraviolet light into a 120-degree beam puts a lot more energy onto those surfaces. The boost from that shaped parabolic reflectors, well, that's dramatic. One more bit of tech before finishing the story. These robots have a lot of sensors that are there to prevent bumping into things, dropping off steps or ridges and so on. But as much as they can run autonomously, they don't. Energy Focus established a disinfection service operation called MUVE Crew. Each robot goes out with at least one trained and certified operator, and it isn't just about the robot's path. If you get too close to high-intensity UVC without wearing appropriate protective gear, you can get skin damage that looks like a bad sunburn. If you look at that UVC source, you can have vision damage, even vision loss, which could be permanent, and eyelids can't block UVC. Safety is the priority task for the MUVE Crew operators, making sure the immediate area is cleared of people and that any who must remain are wearing protection. They even bring along extra eye protectors. They're still very thorough. Whatever pathogens are there when they come are goners when they go. Full operations at the first MUVE Crew HQ began yesterday with four robots and four trained and certified crew members. This first location is in Solon, Ohio, on Cleveland's east side. They can service places within 20 miles of that, which covers most of Greater Cleveland. Energy Focus said they plan 3 more locations over the next 8 months or so, 2 more near Cleveland to cover that area, for a total of 3 Cleveland sites, plus a 4th, somewhere in or near New York City. Yes, you can look forward to robots helping polish the Big Apple. From Solon, they charge $95 or less per hour, plus travel. And you wouldn't believe the van that serves as the robot's limo. Frankly, the enthusiasm from local businesses has been surprising, amazingly eager. Dentists, athletic facilities, event venues, stages, recreation facilities, all over the place. But that part of the story is just beginning. What it makes clear is that the interest in these robots is based not on tech, but on people. On making people feel less hesitant about coming back. This UVC service sends a message about places taking steps to help those clients or customers or patients or work-from-home employees who have been staying away to feel safer about coming back in. So it's about bringing people back and bringing business back. Next time, with so many computer users now on platforms like the Surface, and so many phone users showing interest in more elegant, high-functionality smartphones like the Google Pixel 5, it's time to take a closer look at what compromises result from these simpler platforms. And you'll hear, well, something like a shopper's guide to the products that we love, or don't, to address that. Keyboards and pointing devices and docks and sync services that jump into compatibility gaps, maybe more, in a report we call, "Hey Sport, What Happened to My Ports?" Tune in to learn why even when they cut out the socket, there's still a way to rock it.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. The 45th Trenton Computer Festival took place on March the 20th, 2021. It was a 100% virtual event via Zoom teleconferencing. There were talks and forums via Zoom during the course of the day from 10:15 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., and there were 10 simultaneous track events. Jerry Foster, the CTO and co-founder of Plex Systems, delivered the TCF 2021 keynote speech, "How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Artificial Intelligence." The TCF program guide and grid are available for download and viewing. The initial tracks are available for download on the site tcf-nj.org. The TCF 2021 is free for all, and donations are accepted to offset expenses. Sessions available with video player are online, and other sessions will be online when they are processed. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, May the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, May the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet, and their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, May 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. And the Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, May the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is limac.org. That's limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email address to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.